Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch today's show by going to Ustream channel and then searching for Gary Null. Or you might want to listen over the telephone, and if you do, I'll give you that number right now, because everyday people in cab drivers, a lot of them in New York City, and truck drivers all over America, people traveling who can't be near a land-based station or a internet, can hear over the telephone, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Today, how celery can boost your white blood cell and starves cancer. Medical cannabis, the oil, is healing autism. Almost all food and beverages that are marketed by music stars are unhealthy. Who says? New York University. And I'll deal with a little subset of those issues. I think there's now another famous musician died in the last week. Why are so many musicians dying? And I'll give some input on that, what they could do about it. From McMaster's University, vitamin and mineral supplement prevents brain cell loss. Wow. That's one of the markers of getting older and losing our memory and cognition. So if we could protect those brain cells, good for us. And walnuts may improve your colon health. Eating walnuts changes the gut microbiome and reduces cancer growth. University of Connecticut, and more on health and healing. Also from a man who does a lot to help us better understand mental health, Dr. Bruce Levine from Alternet, 7 reasons America's mental health industry is a threat to our sanity. But I'm going to play a couple of audio clips, including one from Daniel Beatty called Knock Knock. Also, Muhammad Ali. I want to play you a clip that very few people have heard, and then I'm going to play you music going into our first break. And who was the singer at that time? His name was Cassius Clay. He was singing, not Benny King. And then we're going to look at another aspect of the election coming up tomorrow, and I'll give you some input, because we have thousands upon thousands of people listening to this program from California, and they're confused. Should they vote for Jill Stein? Should they vote for Bernie Sanders? They're sure as hell not going to vote for Clinton or Trump. I'll give some perspective. So you see, we have a packed show today, always meant to empower. And also this morning, I was counseling, as I do every day, and some terminally ill people who've tried everything in medicine. What was interesting is the mother and father are of an adult man, both retired school teachers, both listen to this program, and both follow very healthy programs. But their son doesn't. Now has a very life-ending condition. And the doctors kept saying, well, the chemotherapy we tried, it didn't work. We'll try a different chemotherapy. Then that didn't work. Then we'll try another therapy. And the mother says, well, what if that doesn't work? Well, and they had no answer. There are answers to lymphoma. There's multiple cases of people succeeding even with end-stage diseases like cancer using medical marijuana. But why aren't we talking about it? Why haven't you seen in the media people who have reversed end-stage brain cancer, lung cancer, using medical marijuana as a part of an overall protocol? Generally, when someone's getting that protocol, they're getting other juicing and other protocols same time. It's generally a whole shift. There's no discussion of it. But right after that was, I do a lot of work with the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. A lot of them are very much into health in a major way. And with one of the persons I was counseling this morning, I thought, wow, could this audience, the whole audience, everyone listening, benefit from Professor Bruce Lipton? Because so much of what we suffer from comes from early childhood traumas that we've long ago forgotten, but are locked into our DNA. That can turn the DNA into an off position as far as healing. So we're always manifesting different symptoms. So do we work on the symptoms? No, that's not where we should. We should go to the core, the epigenetics. So Bruce Lipton, I'm inviting on to talk about this, and also some other people who deal in reprogramming early traumas so we're no longer impacted by it. It was just, that's one of the things I was suggesting, one of the things in this counseling with this person, and I'm quite sure they're going to do very well because they got a very good support system and they've got a very good mindset to go forward. Remember, your mindset going forward is what determines the outcome. So let's begin. We need to eat a lot more raw, healthy nuts. Almonds, walnuts, one of the best pistachios. Not the roasted and salted type, not the deep-fried cashews, but raw cashews. One of the healthiest nuts you can put in your body is macadamia. Want to make a really delicious meal for yourself? I did this yesterday, in fact. You take out the center of an avocado, remove the seed, though the seeds are very healthy, and you blend that, and you can blend it with some tomatoes and some horseradish, if you want something really nice, and put in some fennel. Now, that makes a very exotic and interesting tasting combination. And then you put that, scoop it, and put that back inside of the avocado. Now you've got an avocado shell that's filled. And then take some of the rice chips, then use that and dip in the rice chip. If you don't want the rice chip, then you can use use celery or cucumber wedges. And it's just a great, what I call a grazing meal. We're not having a big sit-down meal. You're just having something you can graze. And the grazing throughout the day, if you're watching, this is my grazing morning. I have what some people think is a mud dish in the morning when they've seen it. I've let people taste it at different times when they were around, especially when I'm doing any time I do a retreat in the morning, I'm the one who gets up and makes all these really powerful healing gruels and drinks. And I make one separate for myself because it's got everything in the world in it. But it looks like a red mud. It's not. Everything that could possibly heal the body's in there. But during the mid-morning, I drink this. Green apple, which is the majority of it. Ginger, about a 3-inch piece. And the juice of 4 lemons. This is extraordinarily healing. This is very alkalizing. This helps your kidneys, your liver, your urinary tract. This helps your prostate. This helps your skin and your hair. So that's a grazing drink. In the afternoon, you might take some grapes or some kiwis, and you just nosh on them, right? That's grazing. You really should only have one main meal a day, like a sit-down meal, where you enjoy it. You enjoy it with your family, friends, and then a little meal in the evening. If you did that, we wouldn't have overweight. We wouldn't have fatigue. We wouldn't have all the diseases we have, because you're honoring every cell in your body with what you take in it. Well, one of the things we don't take in are walnuts. So in that avocado dish I just mentioned, you could also throw in a handful of walnuts or any nut. So now you're getting two types of healthy oils. You're getting essential fatty acids from the avocado. You're getting essential fatty acids from the walnuts. And walnut oils are great for your heart. They help your heart, they help your lungs, they help your kidneys, and they really help lower the risk of colorectal infections and itises, ileitis, colitis, and cancer, the colon or precancerous polyps. This is from the University of Connecticut, published in Cancer Prevention Journal. Quote, eating walnuts may change gut bacteria in a way that suppresses colon cancer. Team of researchers from the University of Connecticut and the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine found that mice that ate 7% of their total calories as walnuts develop fewer colon cancers. And so there was a 230% fewer tumors than those that had the walnuts. Quote, our results show for the first time that walnut consumption may reduce colon tumor development. There's, quote, there's an accumulation of evidence that eating walnuts may offer a variety of benefits related to health issues like cancer. This study shows that walnuts may also act as a, get this, first time you've ever heard this, as a probiotic to make the colon healthy, which in turn offers protection against colon cancer. Well, until right now, no one knew that walnuts were probiotic. Now add that into what you take. Now, this is about, this is in McMaster's University up in Canada, and they this was published in Environmental and Molecular Mutagenesis. And why do I give the specifics? Because a lot of people listening right now are professionals. We have doctors, scientists, public health officials, dietitians, nutritionists, health and wellness coaches, and they'd like to actually have something that they're going to recommend that they can show someone a study. Well, here, see, this study shows. It's not just empirical. That's why I share that. Quote, the findings are dramatic, said the lead researcher in the professor of the Department of Biology at McMaster University. Our hope is that this supplement could offset some very serious illnesses and ultimately improve quality of life. What are they saying? Vitamin mineral supplement prevents brain cell loss. Now, what are the supplements that are so magical here? Well, B1, B3, B6, B12. Okay, there's your B-complex. Vitamin C, D, and E. Good. Those are your two, your vitamin C and E are major antioxidants, but vitamin D is really probably the most single important of those. Acetyl L-carnitine, that's your brain. Alpha lipoic acid, that's your brain. And bioflavonoids, chromium picolinate, cod liver oil. It's kind of redundant because you're getting that from vitamin D, or you're getting vitamin D and cod liver oil almost the same. Coenzyme Q10, DHEA, now that's a big one. Flaxseed oil, folic acid, garlic, ginger, ginkgo biloba, ginseng, green tea, L-glutathione, magnesium, melatonin, and acetylcysteine, potassium, rutin, selenium, and zinc. And so what they found in this is that there was a huge difference in those that took the multiple vitamin versus those that did not. Quote, this research suggests there is a tremendous potential with a supplement for people who are suffering from some catastrophic neurological disease. So, okay, that's very good. Now, reality check. There are thousands upon thousands of people in this audience who've been taking supplements that have all the things I just mentioned, plus many more they didn't even consider for their brain and overall health. So it's not the it may be the first study published in that publication. It's not the first time people have used something for their brain. But I'm glad that Orthodoxy is at least entertaining or looking into what many of you have been doing for a long time. From New York University, published in the journal Pediatrics. According to artists who are out there recording, these are musicians, and you see their face in these commercials hawking products, and children and adolescents are frequently the target audience. A new study by researchers, quote, at New York University Langone Medical Center finds that the vast majority of the food and beverage products marketed by some of the most popular music stars are unhealthy. And this type of advertising is contributing to the alarming rise in childhood and teen obesity. Soda and other soft drinks, fast foods, and sweets are among the most common food and beverage products endorsed by famous musical personalities, according to the study. Equally alarming, none of the music stars identified in the study endorsed fruits, vegetables, or whole grains. In fact, only one endorsed anything healthy, and that was pistachios. And this is believed to be the first study to use a rigorous nutritional analysis to evaluate healthfulness of food and drinks marketed by music stars. Reviewing dozens of advertisements that were disseminated over a 14-year period. Lead author, Professor Mary Bragg, a professor in the Department of Population Health at New York University, conducted the study. Quote, because of our nation's childhood and teenage obesity and public health crisis, it is important to raise awareness about how companies are using celebrities that are popular with their audiences to market their unhealthy products. And how much is the food industry spending a year on marketing just to youth? $1.8 billion. So I'll put it in this context. Recently, there have been at least 37 very well-known musicians in different fields who have died. Prince was died recently at 57, and it was shown that he had died from an overdose of painkiller medication. But others have died as well from drugs, but more often than not, they die because of unhealthy lifestyles. I remember once when I was doing a study, and I asked for help from a group. I didn't know a group existed. It was the Gay Men and Women's Vegetarians group. And they asked me, would I do a lecture? I said, sure, happy to. A, I support gay rights, and B, I certainly didn't know there was a group, and therefore I would be happy to share anything I could to have them live longer, healthier lives. And so I said that it was my, during this lecture, I said, how many people in this room have sex regularly? All the hands went up. Majority. I said, how many people in here are very strict about their diet? All the hands went up. How many people take supplements? How many take juices? And we went through this for about 2 minutes. I was asking him questions. Hands went up. How many have been tested for HIV? All the hands went up. How many tested positive? Two hands. So I went over to two people, spoke to them, and it turns out their lifestyle, what we would now call a fast-track lifestyle, was what really contributed to their condition. And now, through their friends and partners who lived a healthy lifestyle, they wanted to see if they could help their age-defining illnesses making healthy lifestyle. And I had been working for a long time helping people with age-defining illnesses. Over 1,200 I personally counseled and worked with. And of those 1,200, eight decided to do a vigorous program. And it was tough. 6 days a week, 4 hours a day for 16 months. But the results were we reversed AIDS in every single person. They were totally cured. And the proof was that we had their medical records before and after. Tony Brown of PBS brought them on the air one at a time for an hour each. And we presented them at a press conference. And we did even one of my very first documentaries, AIDS the Real Heroes. 40 people were using natural techniques to deal with their AIDS-defining illnesses. In any case, I said, I'm not familiar with the gay community in downtown, the fast-track gay community. Anyone here know about it could share, you know, help me get in and introduce me to people and let them know I'm a journalist. I'm there to talk with them. And that happened. And I interviewed over 2,000 people over several years. Here's the conclusion. And I wrote this at the very end in an article. And by the way, I wrote the longest article in the history of the Town's Letter for Doctors and Patients on AIDS, but treating it naturally. How you help a person with an AIDS-defining illness get healthy. And I was working with the leading gay doctor in New York City at that time, or one of the leading gay doctors, Dr. Stephen Kaiser, who would come by almost weekly and bring people, introduce them to me, and almost all of them were in that, 90% were in the fast lifestyle. I said this, that if you were to take an Olympic athlete, the strongest, healthiest Olympic athlete in history, a vegan, no drugs, no smoking, training, if you had them do the same identical lifestyle as that small subset, about maybe 2% of the gay population, because 98% of the gay population just live normal lives. They're just normal people. And the vast majority of the things they do each day, in work and socializing, and they're you know, they don't walk around with a sign saying, you know, I'm different. They have differences, of course, which is their right, and I respect those rights. But this subset was living at the edge. Typical evening for two of the partners that I followed for a long period of time, both of whom died. Both were school teachers, got home, they took naps, and then they went out, and then they started partying. Multiple unprotected sex. They used amine nitrate. One of them used 22 amine nitrate in one night. The next day, I brought him a series of studies on poppers and what the poppers would do to a healthy person. It would kill you if you use that many. That was nightly. They weren't alone. A whole group of people were doing it, using all forms of drugs. Cocaine was rampant, alcohol, smoking, and then getting out anywhere from 3 to 5 o'clock in the morning, going home, getting an hour's rest or two, and that same routine. Now, you put a group of Olympic athletes in that same identical situation, they would all be sick or dead within 2 years. And I wrote about it. This was not hearsay. It was not subjective. It was highly objective. I was there. I saw it. Now, what does this have to do with what I'm discussing? Because anyone who lives a fast-track life, anyone who stays up every night late, you're shortening your life. You're making yourself extremely susceptible to disease. I'm not talking about AIDS now. I'm just talking about disease. You're in front of a computer, disease. You're on the cell phone, disease. And we have the studies now showing brain cancer. You're eating junk food, hot dogs, hamburgers, pizzas, pretzels, sugary, disease. Now, if the disease is obesity, and then obesity-related high blood pressure, heart disease, and diabetes, it's still disease. If you walk around angry with an attitude, if you're highly defensive, reactionary, jealous, rageful, disease. There's only one outcome to all this. You're going to die sooner. Now, if the more of these you put together, the more likely you are to get sick quicker, and the more devastating those diseases will be on your system. So, for example, if you were eating junk food, and you were eating a high meat diet, and you were stressed, and you were drinking, and you were smoking, and you didn't get a good night's sleep, you're going to die sooner. You're going to be sick. And then we're going to say, oh my God, one diagnosis and one set of drugs for the diabetes, another diagnosis set for the obesity, another diagnosis for the rotted gums, another one for the irregular heartbeat, another set of drugs and diagnosis for the intermittent claudication. Do you see where it goes? They have taken a human being away from honoring the essence of life, broken it into pieces, labeled the pieces, put it into a medical identification system, give it a value, created diagnosis or treatments for it, none of them curative, and then they commodify you. At the end of the day, you're simply a commodity. And the most profitable commodity in America today, disease. The sicker you are, the more money the medical industrial complex makes from you. So when you as a musician, when you use your popularity and your talents to lead kids into becoming disease models, we have an epidemic of adult diabetes in children, heart disease in children, obesity in children, dental and gum disease in children, arthritis in children. Did you really need the money that bad? Didn't you do any research at all to see whether or not what you're endorsing was what you should endorse? Woody Harrelson wouldn't endorse anything. In my opinion, he wouldn't endorse anything that caused disease, nor a lot of other people who are popular. And as a result, as a group, musicians now, it's all cut up to them. The hard life, staying up night, lots of drugs, lots of alcohol, lots of smoking, lots of stress. And then one day you've reached your destination, and your choices could only lead you to dying. So instead of people being surprised by how these people died, you should wonder, my goodness, look at how long they lived making those bad choices. I just look at this differently. And by the way, what is the solution? I'm going to give some solutions. In fact, in the next 3 months, I will give a lecture that will be televised over the internet. And it's for those who've made bad choices and want to see what they can do to change it. And in August, I'll be helping, if they choose to, if they don't, fine. I got a packed schedule, but I'm willing to set aside a week to help musicians, specifically musicians. And part of this is motivated by the other night I was watching the Temptations film. And wow, what a terrifically talented group of people at a unique time. And yet, look at the lifestyle, the drinking, the drugs, the stress. And the musicians who created that sound, the great musicians who rarely get credit. And many of them are still alive today, but most of them are sick. In fact, the son of a very famous musician just contacted me and says, could you help my dad? And he had been in obscurity for a long time, but I said, sure, I will. Be happy to help. So I'll do it for others, but right now I just want to show that we can reverse this. Because so many people have died who are musicians, I want to show how we can take an aged musician who's lived a rough life, if they're willing to change everything. But here's the key. You got to be willing to change everything. Can we rejuvenate them, get them young biologically again? You bet. Can we help them overcome a lot of these diseases that otherwise are going to take their life? Yes, we can. But they have to want to do that. So I hope you have a strong support system that's willing to be there for you to help turn it around. Because I could just imagine a lot of these other musicians seeing how many have died in the last year, 37 famous ones, and where they're going to be on that chart if the next one's dying. So you can call my office, and you'll speak with Bianca, our receptionist, at 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and tell her, yeah, and it's all in confidence, so give her the name of the person they've got to call, and then we will contact them, and I will put them on a specific protocol to help them, and then only if they do the following. Only if they then do public service announcements about how healthy the choices should be for kids in America. Since we've just seen from this study from New York University that they were willing to do commercials that cause kids to get sick and die early. So let's change our karma, okay? I'm there to help you. I can only provide you with the opportunity and insight. You got to do the rest. Also, this is very important. Medical cannabis is healing autism. That's this latest group of scientists who got together who looked at the chronic maladies that accompany autism and seizures, Crohn's disease, irritable bowel syndrome, nerve damage, neuropathies, chronic pain, and in some cases, any debilitating condition that a physician determines is wholly disabling. So Wayne State and Colorado universities have paved the way for legalizing cannabis completely and regulating its sales, but also that's one of the places they can get the cannabis oil. It's not the smoking of marijuana, it's the cannabis oil. I just want to let you know that it's out there and it can help. And celery boosts your white blood cells and starves cancer. Quote, celery has been a traditional Asian folk remedy for many ailments for thousands of years. If you think celery is just a crunchy, low-cal vegetable, it's time to bring it in to your nutrition on a regular basis. Think again. It has strong, powerful, healing, anti-inflammatory benefits. It can protect you against inflammation in the digestive tract, and Dr. James Duke found more than 20 anti-inflammatory compounds in celery and celery seeds, including a substance called apigenin, A-P-I-G-E-N-I-N, which is powerful in its anti-inflammatory action. And and it starves cancer, quote, as a cancer-fighting bioflavonoid. Apigenin has also been studied in relation to breast and ovarian cancers. A University of Missouri study found that apigenin shrank a type of breast cancer that's stimulated by progestin, a synthetic hormone often given to menopausal women. So, for cancer, celery juice every day. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. We have a lot more to share. Please stay with us. That was then named Cassius Clay, later to become Muhammad Ali, great fighter, good singer. Now, this is from Dr. Bruce Levine, and it's a good piece. It's an alternate. It's called Seven Reasons America's Mental Health Industry is a Threat to Our Sanity. Quote, why do some of us become dissident mental health professionals? The majority of psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals go along to get along and maintain a status quo that includes drug company corruption, pseudo-scientific research, and a standard of care that is routinely damaging and often kills young children. If that sounds hyperbolic, then you probably have not heard of Rebecca Riley and how the highest level psychiatry described her treatment as, quote, appropriate and within responsible professional standards. When Rebecca Riley was 28 months old, based primarily on complaints of her mother that she was hyper and had difficulty sleeping, psychiatrist at the Tufts New England Medical Center in Boston diagnosed Rebecca with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, mind you, this is 28 months. The psychiatrist prescribed clonidine, a hypertensive drug with significant sedating properties, a drug the psychiatrist also prescribed to Rebecca's older sister and brother. The goal of the Riley's parents, obvious to many in their community and later to juries, was to attain psychiatric diagnosis for their children that would qualify them for disability payments and to sedate their children, making them easy to manage. By the time Rebecca was 3 years old, again based mainly upon parental complaints, the psychiatrist had given Rebecca an additional diagnosis of bipolar disorder and prescribed two additional heavily sedating drugs, the antipsychotic Seroquel and an anticonvulsant Depakote. At the age of four, Rebecca died. At the time of her death, Rebecca had life-threatening amounts of clonidine, enough to kill her, in her body. According to the former director of the Massachusetts Toxicological Lab and the medical director of a regional poison control center, the medical examiner who performed the autopsy concluded that Rebecca died from intoxication of clonidine and Depakote and two other over-the-counter cough and cold medicines that led to the heart failure, lungs filled with bloody fluid, coma, and then death. Well, what happened to the doctor? Nothing. The psychiatric establishment rallied around the doctor, the psychiatrist, enabling her to return to Tufts Medical Center, practicing child psychiatry without any restrictions, penalties, or supervision. After Rebecca's death, Tufts New England Medical Center defended the psychiatrist. In fact, the Tufts spokesman told 60 Minutes, quote, the care we provided was appropriate and within responsible professional standards. Apparently, psychiatric care that is considered appropriate within responsible professional standards includes diagnosing ADHD for a 2-year-old and bipolar disorder for a 3-year-old when the symptoms of those disorders are normal behaviors for those ages. Prescribing 3 heavily sedating drugs that have not been approved by the FDA for child psychiatric treatment, ignoring the warnings from a school nurse about overdosing of Rebecca, and making diagnosis based entirely upon reports from Rebecca's mother, who herself was diagnosed with mental illness and heavily medicated to the point of falling asleep in the psychiatrist's office. Long before Rebecca Riley tragedy hit the headlines, I was embarrassed by the medical health profession for 7 major reasons. 1, corruption by Big Pharma. How did it become within responsible professional standards for a 2-year-old to get an ADHD diagnosis, for a 3-year-old to get a bipolar diagnosis, for toddlers to be prescribed multiple heavy sedating drugs? The short answer is drug company corruption of the mental health profession. 2, invalid illnesses and disorders. Psychiatry's first DMS, 1952, and its DMS-2 in 1968 listed homosexuality as a mental illness. Only because of fierce political fight waged in the 1970s by gay activists did the American Psychiatric Association abolish homosexuality as an illness and eliminate it from their DSM-3 in 1980. Gay activists' fight was not only a victory for themselves, but a service for everyone else, as it made the public the important scientific program of psychiatric disorder invalid. Specifically, are psychiatric disorders scientifically valid illnesses? The answer is no. None of them are. 3, scientifically unreliable diagnosis. Even if you believe that bipolar disorder for a 3-year-old or 2-year-old, or ODD for teenagers, and all of the other statistical manual diagnoses are valid disorders, there is absolutely no scientific diagnostic process to show that they're reliable. Hence, they do not exist. 4, biochemical imbalance, mumbo-jumbo. Just as nothing was more important in selling the Iraq War in 2003 than the Bush administration's certainty that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, nothing has been more important in selling psychiatric drugs than psychiatry's certainty of biochemical brain imbalances as a cause of mental illness. Prior to psychiatry's proclamation that depression was caused by too little of the neurotransmitter serotonin, few Americans were taking antidepressants, but by declaring that depression was caused by a serotonin imbalance analog similar to diabetes and insulin imbalance, depressed Americans became more receptive to serotonin-enhancing drugs like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft. And SSRIs can make some depressed people feel better for a period of time, but alcohol also makes shy people less shy. But that's not enough evidence to say that shyness is caused by an alcohol imbalance. The truth is, the scientists have known this for quite some time, that serotonin levels are not associated with depression. 5, pseudoscientific drug effectiveness research, meaning they're not doing any quality research. 6, psychotropic drug hypocrisy. Chemists consider psychiatric prescription drugs and illegal mood-altering drugs all to be psychotropic or psychoactive drugs. Cocaine and ADHD drugs such as Adderall and other amphetamines affect the neurotransmitters dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, and antidepressants used in combination also affect the same neurotransmitters. Not only are prescription psychotropics and illegal psychotropics chemically similar, they're used by people for the similar reasons, including taking the edge off their discomfort so they can function. The hypocrisy surrounding illegal and prescription psychotropic drugs is harmful to society in at least 2 ways. And it's simple. And by the way, 7 is diversion from societal, cultural, and political sources of misery. And where he says there is just, hey, during life, bad things happen, things about our control happen, so let's help a person cope, but not give him a diagnosis and a drug. He is right. Also, Daniel Beattie is right when he tells us what happens in a society that's lost its sense of perspective on reality. This is called Knock Knock.
As a boy, I shared a game with my father. Played it every morning till I was 3. He would knock-knock on my door, and I'd pretend to be asleep till he got right next to the bed. Then I would get up and jump into his arms. Good morning, Papa. And my papa, he would tell me that he loved me. We shared a game, knock, knock. Until that day when the knock never came. And my mama takes me on a ride past cornfields on this never-ending highway till we reach a place of high, rusty gates. A confused little boy, I enter the building carried in my mama's arms. Knock, knock. We reach a room of windows and brown faces. Behind one of the windows sits my father. I jump out of my mama's arms and run joyously towards my papa's, only to be confronted by this window. I knock, knock, trying to break through the glass, trying to get to my father. I knock, knock as my mama pulls me away before my papa even says a word. And for years he has never said a word. And so 25 years later, I write these words for the little boy in me who still awaits his papa's knock. Papa, come home, because I miss you. Miss you waking me up in the morning and telling me you love me. Papa, come home, because there's things I don't know, and I thought maybe you could teach me how to shave, how to dribble a ball, how to talk to a lady, how to walk like a man. Papa, come home, because I decided a while back I want to be just like you, but I'm forgetting who you are. And 25 years later, a little boy cries, and so I write these words and try to heal and try to father myself, and I dream up a father who says the words my father did not, dear son. I'm sorry I never came home. For every lesson I fail to teach, hear these words. Shave in one direction with strong, deliberate strokes to avoid irritation. Dribble the page with the brilliance of your ballpoint pen. Walk like a god, and your goddess will come to you. No longer will I be there to knock on your door, so you must learn to knock for yourself. Knock, knock down doors of racism and poverty that I could not. Knock, knock on doors of opportunity for the lost brilliance of the black men who crowd these cells. Knock, knock with diligence for the sake of your children. Knock, knock for me, for as long as you are free, these prison gates cannot contain my spirit. The best of me still lives in you. Knock, knock with the knowledge that you are my son, but you are not my choices. Yes, we are our father's sons and daughters, but we are not their choices. But despite their absences, we are still here, still alive, still breathing, with the power to change this world, one little boy and girl at a time. Knock, knock, who's there? We are.
This is Muhammad Ali. A short piece, but it also tells a story about how a very powerful, proud, and self-observed person can stand up to the institutional racism in a country that embraced the Vietnam War, embraced fascism, embraced segregation.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor, hungry people in the mud. For big, powerful America, and shoot them for what? They never called me. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. Well, I'm going to shoot them for what? How can I go shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? I'll just take me to jail.
Ali more than held his own against students who had a far better formal education than he.
I'm saying you're talking about me, about some draft, and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Short piece from Muhammad Ali. Now, for all in this audience who are thinking about voting for Hillary Clinton, consider what the Clintons did to people of color. That's why I play the knock knock. Because think of the millions, not just now, 2.4 million incarcerated. Think of all the people who are there for nonviolent crimes, for just having some marijuana, being stopped. They were stopped because of a racist policy the President of the United States could have stopped instantly with an executive order. No more profiling. No more stopping 90% of people who are in poor neighborhoods or neighborhoods where you don't believe they should be, and then saying, what's in your pocket? Take what's in your pocket out. And when they take the marijuana out, then you arrest them. They go to jail for 7 years. They get longer sentences because they are black than a white kid for the same offense. Who is responsible for this? The largest increase in incarceration in America, if not the world history, was because of the Clintons. Then again, they caused more jobs to be offshored with NAFTA than any previous trade deal, and yet they go to the unions and say we're pro-union, and they go into black churches saying we're pro-black. And 36 women claimed that Hinton, Bill Clinton sexually assaulted him. He had bragged to his 15-year lover, who is around today, a lawyer, a woman, who said that back in the 1980s, he bragged to me that he had already 3,000 sexual conquests. Well, some of those women were not consenting, called rape. If you define being a feminist as attacking the women who claimed they were raped, what type of feminism is that? If you claim, Hillary, you're a feminist, and you do not stand up for the women in Saudi Arabia who are abused, have no rights, are beheaded or stoned to death, and the homosexuals that are abused in Saudi Arabia and stoned to death, if you do not stand up for the women in Afghanistan and Iraq, if you do not stand up to the women, over at least 5,000 women died because of you in Libya. And what was Libya? Was Gaddafi a threat? Not to us, he was not. He was working with us. Was he helping his people? Of all 54 countries in Africa, his was the most advanced. They were the wealthiest. People had the most rights. Women had the most rights, equal to men. And he shared his wealth with his country and with his citizens. There was no crime. People had high-quality standards of living. They had the best medical care in Africa. They could go anywhere in the world, and it wouldn't cost them a penny to get medical care. They were given a house or an apartment when they were married. They were given a car. They were given farms. They had a better form of democracy in Libya under Gaddafi, who is no superstar in my book, grossly flawed person, but show me what we do for Americans by giving them free health care, free education, a home free, $50,000 when you're married. Do we do that? We don't do that. And yet Hillary Clinton was responsible. It was her war. And think of the women who died and the others who lived but are suffering. It is a completely failed terrorist state now. So what kind of feminism is it that you're promoting, and what kind of feminists would support you? I'm going to ask for some talk back after you hear this. You can talk back on this at 888-874-4888. This is a person, a member of the media, asking a question. And by the way, the people, you don't see them, but all the people he's asking this are at the, these are all blacks at a Clinton Democrat rally.
Hello, I'm here in Charleston, South Carolina at the Democratic presidential primary debate to find out why do black people still like Hillary Clinton?
When I say Hillary, you say Clinton. Hillary
Clinton!
I've been reading this book, The New Jim Crow, and it's got some gnarly stuff about Hillary Clinton. It says when her husband was president, she lobbied Congress to increase the drug war and mass incarceration. And the best-selling author of the book, civil rights lawyer Michelle Alexander, says Bill Clinton's tough-on-crime policies resulted in the largest increase in federal and state prison inmates of any president in American history. But Clinton was not satisfied with exploding prison populations. He and the New Democrats championed legislation banning drug felons from public housing and denying them basic public benefits, including food stamps for life. Discrimination in virtually every aspect of political, economic, and social life is now perfectly legal if you've been labeled a felon. What do you think about that, 1994 Hillary Clinton?
It's a very well thought out crime bill that is both smart and tough.
Awkward!
What book is it?
It's called New Jim Crow, New York Times bestseller. It's called During Bill Clinton's Tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, boosted corrections by $19 billion, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor. I'm just trying to get confirmation.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, Debbie. Why should you know? You're only the chair of the Democratic National Committee. Hey, black people, help me out.
Would you say that you've been able to forgive her and her husband for tough-on-crime policies that led to mass incarceration?
I can't talk to New York.
I can't answer that right now because I want to cheer for Hillary.
Can I ask any questions?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you.
You're good?
Can't talk to the press, sorry.
Why not?
Just don't want to answer the question.
But it is part of, like, history and reality, right?
Right.
I'm trying to find out why black people still like the Clintons.
Oh, man. Not even the South Carolina head of communications for Bernie Sanders' campaign will talk shit about Hillary.
During Bill Clinton's tenure, Washington slashed funding for public housing by $17 billion, boosted corrections by $19 billion, effectively making the construction of prisons the nation's main housing program for the urban poor, and Hillary championed these policies and lobbied Congress for them. Can you please speak to that?
So what I will say is there has not been another poll in South Carolina for a little bit of a while, but we feel the momentum and our ground game is on our side and that we are feeling things shift.
Wow, Simone, that was a great answer. It just happened to be to a completely different question from the one I asked you.
One out of three.
Okay. Historically correct. Maybe he had 17 cups of coffee before he went out there. He could use a little meditation, but his concept was correct. Hillary's relying, along with Bill and the Democratic Party, on the black vote, Latino vote. Did you look at what the United States and Clinton's did to Puerto Rico and the debt that they've accumulated and the pensions they're cutting? I'd like to hear from you now. Give a call at 888-874-4888. And while you're thinking about calling in or not, on tomorrow, I thought it was very smart and the right thing to do when Jill Stein, the third-party candidate for the Green Party, suggested in a letter that in California, she's only talking about California, vote for Bernie Sanders. Because then if Bernie wins California, then the Green Party and Jill Stein could work with Bernie Sanders. It's a smart move. I think she'd make the best vice presidential candidate. She would make a great president, but he, with her, would keep them in a great cooperative position. So Bernie has a lot of problems with foreign policy. He has supported funding of all the wars, though he has been against the wars. He funds them. Well, if you're really against the wars, don't fund them. If you don't have money to pay for wars, there are no wars. We wouldn't have any wars. We didn't have money to do that. And also stop manufacturing weapons and selling them to all the countries of the world. We're the number one in that. So where he is absolutely on the right side of history on many issues, she is on the right side of all issues. And I think that would be terrific. So that's just my input. Let's say hello to Lincoln from Mount Vernon. Hi, Lincoln. Your turn.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Yeah. Why black people still support Hillary Clinton? It is because of the brainwashing that still hangs over us and the slave mentality that we still do hold. I remember when I first saw Bill Clinton on Arsenio Hall's show, and he was dressed like a black jazz musician. And I'd never seen him before. I didn't know about him as a governor of Arkansas. And I said to someone, I said, that's the next president. And they said, why? I said, because black people would be so happy to say, oh, nice white man. And that is the main reason, because most of us function with an Uncle Tom mentality, no matter how much education we have. We don't realize how much this system is still deep in our subconscious. And until we get away from that, we will continue to be the slaves we are. And that's one of the reasons why we can't, we cannot scold people like Obama for killing Gaddafi. And Obama and Hillary killing Gaddafi is the greatest black-on-black crime. And black people fail to acknowledge that because we're so happy that one of us got into the White House. And there's more to be said, but I'll give someone else another chance.
Lincoln, thank you very much. I appreciate your input. But we're out of time now, so I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.